Is this thing on?
Working? Jeff, is it working?
I hear you.
No, I know this part's working. I'm wondering if the live thing's working. It should be working.
All right. Well, it says that we have some people in the audience. So if you can hear us, say, you know, chat something. There we go. Jen helped us out. The live thing is working.
Oh, I can see them too. It's kind of fun playing the idiot here.
Yeah, playing.
Easy tag. True.
Well, welcome everyone to the second ever First Fridays. It is the first Friday of December, obviously. So we are queuing up another one here. This is also the first Friday with our new podcast name. In case anyone missed it on our rough cut that we dropped yesterday or social media posts, The Smattering is now going by Investing Unscripted. This is entirely for search result reasons. We are blatantly trying to make it easier for people to find our podcast. Other than the name, nothing shall change. So just keep that in mind.
No more than stuff changes anyway, right, Jeff? That's right. But no, you're right, Jeff. I was cutting you off as you were saying it. We do. We have a special guest. He is a guest, and he is certainly special. Jim Gillies.
The word special is doing a lot of work in that sentence, but thank you. Thank you for having me. May you live to regret it.
That's the hope. That's the hope.
I think the reality is that I've been on shows with you, Jim. We're having you, but you're about to have us. That's how these things go. Are you ready to be triggered? I don't know if you have the chat pulled up there, Jim.
I see Trejo is Tejo?
Trejo? Tejo, yeah. Tejo is coming in hot. Hey, yeah. Guys. Jim, how close are you owning a Cybertruck? So for those that don't know, I'll give a brief, just a brief one. Cena's here. Hey, Cena.
Okay.
For those that don't know, Jim Gillies is with the Molly Fool. He's, I guess you're a senior advisor,
yeah.
Stock picker extraordinary. He is Canada's chief bottle washer. Now you're down the line. You have chief bottle washers in charge, but you're pretty big bacon up there. So,
I mean, sure.
It's Tejo. Well, almost. Right. I live in Mexico, but not Mexican. Trejo would be a cool name. Okay. Tejo, thank you for clarifying that for us very much. Jim, so we had you on a couple of reasons. Number one, you're a lot of fun. You're a lot of fun in these sorts of life situations. Oh, you are. It may not be fun for everybody, but it's fun for those of us that know what we're looking for. But the excuse we had was the passing of Charlie Munger. That was a good cover to invite you on.
I do have an alibi.
How reliable is your alibi?
I already know what we were going to ask.
Carry on.
Yeah. So we spent some time with you in Omaha at the last Berkshire Hathaway meeting, which of course was the last meeting Charlie was ever going to be at. For a lot of us, it was our first time being there. Before we get into things though, and really kind of get into the meat of our show, and we're going to answer questions too. If you haven't figured out the chat button there on the side, look in the bottom right, you'll see the little purple chat. Click that, ask us questions, get engaged. This has turned into a little bit of a drinking game for a lot of people. So share that with us, because I'm sure Cena and Jen are going to be interested in hearing and sharing. But before we get into it, I do want to talk a little bit about Charlie Munger, his passing, maybe some thoughts about Jim, and I'll ask you to kick this off a little bit here, but you know, what he meant to you, how you view him as an investor, his legacy. I'll let you just kind of wax poetic for a few minutes, and then I do have a series of questions we can each kind of weigh in on.
Sure. I mean, I covered a little bit of this this morning on if I don't know if you can see, I've got a stuffed plushie of Charlie Munger sort of in my background, but it's a little narrow, so I don't know what is actually being seen by the folks out there. And if you were to walk into my office, which if you did, that'd be really weird because me, you're in my house. The right outside my office door, there are pictures of a younger, grayer, sorry, less gray me, with both Buffett and Munger at a couple of different Berkshire meetings. So, I take my Buffett and Munger appreciation very seriously. Maybe I'll try to kick it off in a little bit of a more controversial stake. I don't really follow Charlie as a quote unquote investor.
Okay.
Because I think he's more than that. I think he was a 21st century man, even though, of course, he was born in 1924.
The Renaissance man, no doubt about it.
Very much a Renaissance man. And,
I agree.
And, you know, and if the cliche, if the parenting cliche is don't teach your kids or don't tell your kids what to think, teach them how to think. I think Charlie was our man trying to teach us how to think. And so the lessons I take from Charlie are less like, I can't give you a Charlie Munger quintessential stock pick that I think is terribly great, frankly. Although fools who regularly tune into Motley Fool Live, where I occasionally make, will hear me quite often say, I don't own enough Costco. And of course, Charlie was on the board of Costco, and, you know, would speak lovingly about how it was such a fantastic company, how it was a meritocracy, how they had focused relentlessly on driving success for their customers, and as a function of that would drive success for themselves. And, you know, like I think somewhere Charlie's probably very happy that the new CEO, the incoming CEO of Costco, is a 40-year employee who started as a forklift driver. I think that's fantastic, and I'm pretty sure he did as well. But I've always loved, like, you know, I've got, you know, my copy of Poor Charlie's Almanac, which usually resides in this office, is downstairs in my living room on the coffee table for the foreseeable future.
New edition comes out next week, Jim.
I have a, mine's about a 20-year-old edition, I think, so probably should get a new one. It's much of the same things, but, you know, but like you know, Charlie was known for his, you know, kind of quick aphorisms and kind of very, you know, like just the quotable Charlie kind of thing, and trying to be, you know, kind of a wisdom you wanted to have. So, you know, I mean, like whether it's the very famous, of course, invert, always invert, you know, one of my things that I like from him, embrace your mistakes. I actually have, I have my own on my computer here. I have what I call my list of Jim's rules for living. I think I'm up to 46 or 47 now. And, you know, one of them is, you know, people will do almost anything rather than admit they're wrong. And so corollary to that is to admit you're wrong early and often and as many times as possible. Like, you know, go looking for your mistakes. Take the, you know, take them as an opportunity to learn and to get better as an investor, to get better as a person. You know, the idea of, you know, knowing what you don't know, you know, one another one from him, knowing what you don't know is more useful than being brilliant. And, you know, boy, there's some implications there for a few investors, if you really want to look at it, but I'll bet you a few won't because they don't want to be considered to think about being wrong. The desire to get rich fast is dangerous. The world is not driven by greed. I loved this. The world is not driven by greed. It is driven by envy, right? And as Jeff, I mean, Jeff was mouthing along with me because, you know, he knows exactly what I'm talking about. You know, a life properly lived is to learn. He talks about Buffett being a learning machine, always be learning something. And another good one for some of us, maybe. Maybe not for others. The first rule of a happy life is to have low expectations.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the, you know, and we could go on.
I tell
on
my wife that every single day.
Well, I mean, you know, and I hope she responds back to you, and I do, and looks
I'm
very pointedly.
I'm curious why Jeff's telling my wife that every day. There's I'm not even going to go down that road. Right.
Yeah, and finally, just the last one that I've always appreciated, I'll give you two, actually, two, just because I've got a couple on my screen here. The first one, I think there's some nuance we could, the second one, I'll say that for a second. The first one is, Charlie said, I had a considerable passion to get rich, not because I wanted Ferraris, but because I wanted independence.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is, I think the proper context for money. We all, you know, we all envision having FU money. Which is a surprisingly lower amount of money than I think people realize, certainly lower than what Mr. Munger exited this earth holding. But we can all appreciate the, you know, the desirability of having FU money. And so I really like that. But the last one I'm going to throw out to you, just because I think it could, again, provoke some people. And if anyone knows anything about me, you'll know I occasionally like to provoke. If you're not willing to react with equanimity to a market price decline of 50% two or three times a century, you're not fit to be a common shareholder. Now, that's he's talking about broad markets there. But boy, has that been a misappropriated quote and directed at individual stocks. And I don't think Munger intended for it to be the refrain of people who are like, I'm down 50%. This is amazing. And then to watch the stock fall 90% from there. But it's certainly been misapplied in that fashion. So there's some thoughts on Munger. If you don't like them, I have others.
No, I really like how one of those things that's kind of obvious but you don't think of it till someone says it. The idea of not thinking of him as a stock picker, I think, is interesting. And as you said it, I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Cause, you know, Jason and I recorded a live show with the Chit Chat Money guys on Thursday. And then we also, did a little bit about Munger on our quick podcast we dropped yesterday to announce the name change. And I'm thinking back on everything we talked about. None of it was about picking any particular stock or an investing move that, you know, Munger made. It was all about exactly what you just said, his desire to keep learning, his desire to teach people how to think. And, you know, we talk about that a lot on this podcast. Just kind of those rules for life that also happen to be things that make you a good investor. I think there's so much overlap in his wisdom that, yeah, it's funny. We've been talking about it for like a week now, and it hasn't really been about any particular investing moves. So.
I think to a certain extent that was maybe intentional for Charlie, because you think about the role he played, and this is for those that watch this on Chit Chat, this is going to be a little redundant. There's only so much we can really say here, Jim, I think it gets to what you were talking about as far as Charlie as being more of a Renaissance man. He clearly loved business and he loved the pursuit. There's no mm-hmm. doubt that he loved that aspect of it. And he was a great foil for Buffett, and he was great for Buffett to have somebody that was maybe kind of counterintuitive to the way that he approached and thought about things, was looking for similar things, but maybe went about finding them in a different way, right? There was just enough, they were out of phase just enough that I think it was maybe one of the most powerful things about that partnership, right? Was they were just slightly out of phase with their approach. And the kind of the point is that that's what Buffett needed, and yes. Charlie didn't need to be the lead singer in the band. He had other interests and other pursuits, and I can't remember where it came from. And I think it was Brett that said it on the recording that said that you can't give Buffett credit for being the best investor in modern time. You have to give it to Charlie Munger because Charlie was smart enough to give all of his money to Warren, right?
That's a good point.
And then he can go do all this other great stuff that he really loved to do. And I think that's really, to me, that's a kind of a powerful thing. And maybe something a lot of us could take is maybe that's the real lesson.
Especially in a world where everyone feels like they have to have a hot take on everything. You know,
everybody can, right? That's the...
Well, yeah. But that has driven people to feel like they need to. Mm-hmm. And I think... To your point about he didn't feel the need to be the lead singer, I think that in and of itself is a life lesson. You know, kind of know your role and know that even a supporting role is crucial. You know, to the movie. To use
I just heard the words "know your role" in The Rock's voice. I just want you to know that probably the first time in your life you'll ever be compared to The Rock.
Yeah, I've been compared to a lot of people, and it's never been The Rock. So thanks.
Know your role as a deep cut there for people.
We've got some pretty good comments coming in here that I want to share. They're apropos of nothing.
Mostly about drinking, it appears.
They are. This was funny. And Teo, I want to give you a lot of credit here. A lot of talking about drinking going on, but Teo says, we've got the work Christmas party tonight. Can't hit the beer or anything else for that matter. It'll be a tragedy. Sounds to me like it'd be a comedy, but you know, good for you.
I have comedy
is tragedy plus time. Remember? So
there you go.
You'll be spoken of for years.
Comedy usually can sometimes turn into tragedy. All right. I wanted to tip to Ken.
See Ken joining us. So good to see you here, Ken.
Yes. Go ahead, Jeff. Ken is a loyal listener and a good friend. So good to see him in the chat. All right. Here's my interesting, maybe it's not interesting. Tell me if this is a stupid question, but I've been wondering this. So one of the things that I thought about with Munger is not so much that he lived to be 99. I mean, that's incredible. For someone who invest, you know, was an investor, I was thinking about how much changed in the stock market or just how investing works and functions over the course of his life. But then it got me thinking, like, how much changed even after his like 60th or 70th or 80th birthday?
Yeah.
And that sort of got me thinking, that was incredible to me, just the fact that, you know, how much change there's been in the market. So here's my question. If the three of us live to be 99, will we see as much change in how the investing world works between now and then as Munger did between his, let's say, 40s and 50s until he died?
Jim?
I mean, I'm just thinking of all the change because I've been doing this. I think I bought my first stock in 1996. Sadly, it wasn't Berkshire Hathaway. Well, that was 2000, though, so we're fine, or 99, somewhere in there. I'm just thinking about the change I've seen.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like,
and, you know, and I mean, you know, I'm in my early 50s. And so it's, you know, like I'm not paying $30 a transaction anymore. I'm not seeing price quotes in eight, which is what we used to have. You know, Jason and I were talking pre-show, and, you know, I relate a story where, you know, I transacted in the era when stocks were priced in eighths of a dollar for whatever reason.
Yeah, no fractions anymore.
Yeah, the accessibility to information, which I thought in the late 90s, early 2000s was so much better than the stories I'd heard what it was like in the 70s and 60s. Today, it's light years ahead. So, I mean, that, of course, gives a little credence to the, you know, the fine folks who like to teach the efficient market theory because, oh, all information is reflected in stock prices at all time. It isn't. Sorry to spoil it for you. And I used to teach this stuff too.
But Jim, that kind of goes to like we were saying this the other day, like that's sort of where the superpower of the way Charlie looked at the world, I think, comes in. In a world where everyone has the same information at the same time and computers can get to it even quicker than we can, like you have to invert. You have to do all the things he talks about doing or else you have no advantage.
Yeah. Well, and if I can go in a weird direction on that thing, because I really want, so I'm going to flatter myself and probably come across as arrogant and I apologize in advance.
Well, you have to, because we won't.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Perfect. I've been told I occasionally look at certain stocks differently than other people. Okay. I didn't say positive or negative. I just said differently. And it's kind of, you know, I'm going to go in a weird direction. It's kind of why I'm not terribly, you know, concerned about this whole move to AI and artificial intelligence and ChatGPT and whatever like that. You know, and people say, oh, you know, our investor is going to be replaced because, you know, ChatGPT can pick stocks better. It's like, so far, and this might change, and this might be how we get Skynet. But like, so far, the ability to aggregate information, to see information, does not mean you necessarily can interpret and that information properly or tax out the real implications of what that information means. And like, I've taken one marketing course in my life, okay? But the professor, and I'm not a marketer, and I used to like just rattle that poor old professor. It was probably a bit of an ass, frankly. Stop laughing. He was a really great guy. He's sadly no longer with us, but he was a really great guy. But some of the key lessons I remember from my MBA program are from him. And one of the things he always used to say is, what is the implication? What is the implication? Like, it doesn't, like, it's not enough to have the information. Anyone can regurgitate financial ratios. Anyone can go look, you know, we can all, whether we want to do it or not is one thing, but we can all do the regurgitation and the cut and paste and the stock, you know, revenue grew 25% this quarter. What is the implication? How does it work with all of the other finances going on? What is the implication of, you know, management's moves? How, like, and maybe in my own way, I'm trying to emulate Charlie and kind of have that mosaic theory and bring that whole thing together to try to see, we all see through a glass darkly, but to try to see through that glass a little bit less darkly, which again, I think was one of Charlie's big gifts.
Well, and I think Charlie also did a lot to try to communicate that idea to as many people as he could, you know, the specific thing you're talking about, and it's become more and more prevalent now with there's knowing information, but then there's understanding the theory to assimilate all of that into some useful framework to arrive at a better decision. You know, that's exactly what you're talking about. And Charlie wrote about that. It's one of the speeches in Poor Charlie's Almanac. Mm-hmm. Talks about exactly this, mm-hmm. this thing that you're talking about. And he talked about how important, like the most important thing that you can do is teach somebody, right? Help somebody know more is really powerful. I'm going to interrupt because I hope John is still on. John Gallegos is calling with the following question. So I think I can actually promote John to join the audience.
Ooh, this will be the first time we've tried this.
I'm going to try this because John is a known entity. We've all met John. John is also a big fan of my Atlanta Braves. So I'm willing to take this risk here. So John, I'm going to read your question, then I'm going to call you on and you can refine it. We'll talk about it a little bit here. Would the panel ever feel at a certain period in your investing experience to start being less diversified with your stock portfolio, such as Charlie? So I'm going to invert that. And instead of start being less diversified, increase your concentration in your portfolio. John, I just clicked it. Let's see, John. Let's see
there
if it brings you in.
There he is.
There he is. John, hey buddy.
Gentlemen. Hey, John.
How we doing?
Good. Good to see you. Good to see you. How's Arizona treating you?
Nice. Nice. It was just rainy, so it's a little cold today. About 63 today. So
it's yeah, that's not cold, but it's nice of you.
What's
to
that in Canadian? It's funny.
You're talking about three guys from the Northeast. So, John, right. Are you asking the question because it's something you've been thinking about, or are you just curious generally?
Yeah. Basically, at what point, right? Because I know Jim's been doing it quite a long time. I know Jason as well, and Jeff, maybe not as long, but at what point would you start being more concentrated? I guess the better term is concentrated, right? Into those big.
Well, what do you consider concentrated? Three positions? Because Charlie at one point famously, I think it was the 70s, had like 90% of his wealth in three stocks. You know,
no, I'd say something between like 10 to 15. Because when I look on Datorama, you're right, he only had four, I think less than five, right? You can go on there and kind of see what these super investors have and what their portfolios look like. So
I will fully admit, John, I am, I've got probably in my portfolio, and I'll do option exposure and forget index funds. I probably got, or index ETFs now, because we don't do mutual funds anymore. We do ETFs, right? All the cool kids do those. Aside from index things, which I've got four or five of those that are probably about a third of mine and Lou's portfolio, 40%, 35, 40%. I've probably got exposure to 110 different stocks. And the problem is, aside from the fact that I incur some heavy taxes to get down to 10, I'm a collector. I'm very much in the Peter Lynch, the Peter Lynch mold, the Shelby Davis mold. I think I'm just going to own a lot of stocks because, you know, my whole investing process is, hey, this is a cool company. I want to own some of this. And then 2 weeks later, hey, this is a cool company. I want to own some of this. And I'm in the business where I'm picking 24 stocks a year minimum for various fool products, not least of which is Hidden Gems Canada. And so, you know, asking me to whittle down my roster of favorites to 10 or 20 or even 50, I'm just not going to be able to do it. So I just, you know, I'm just like, yeah, I don't care. I'm gonna own what I'm gonna own, and I'm gonna be fine. Eric says Star Wars Lego Man is a collector. Color me shocked. Eric, you have no idea because you can't see that wall. There is about 10 times as much on that wall as there is behind.
That's fantastic. So I'll go ahead. Go ahead, Jeff.
I mean, I'll as the least experienced person here, I'll just share the things that I've been thinking about recently. So
I mean, you're a pretty experienced person. You're just not a very experienced.
Well, with this kind of a question, because all I had up until 4 years ago was, you know, basically mutual funds or index funds that I was invested in through my retirement account. So it was all, you know, it was no individual picking and diversification wasn't really an issue. I've been trying to get more concentrated, but it's a completely personal thing with me. And it comes from, it just bothers me. And this is dumb, but I'm being honest. It just bothers me that there's certain stocks in my portfolio that are really tiny, I don't care about, or I don't want to own anymore. And that I'm just constantly compelled to get rid of them, even though they're meaningless. Like having them or not, it rounds to zero. Like there's no difference in my life. So part of me, some days I say to myself, well, why don't I just leave them there? Because what's the harm? It's like a couple $100. And maybe in 25 years, they'll break even. And then part of me is like, they annoy me. I want them out. I want to see less, you know? So I think it for me, it probably just boils down to how OCD I'm feeling on any given day about it. But one thing I've talked about this on the podcast, because I'm 88 to 90% in index funds across my wife and I's invested wealth, I probably could or even should have less individual stocks. Like it makes no sense to be overly diversified in that with that 10%-ish of my portfolio is kind of the way I'm thinking about it right now. But I'm glad I didn't. I think what's holding me back is feeling like I still don't know what I don't know yet. And I'm trying to just make changes cautiously and slowly. So that's how I think about it.
Yeah, I think a little bit. So like Jim, I'm a little bit of a collector too. Although I'm down from in the 120s to about 95. So I've
tried concentration.
That's for me. That's super.
See, it's relative. Right? It's relative.
But the thing about it is, like, if you actually look at like my actual wealth, I'd say I haven't looked at it in a month or so. But last time I looked at it, something like 60% of my portfolio was concentrated in like 20 positions. So
yeah, I was about to say my top 15 positions are, again, forget the index ETFs. My top 15 stocks, Jason, are probably close to 50%. I've got two 10 percenters.
Right. Right.
In mine.
Yeah.
So. And I'd imagine over time, mine will end up being like that too. Yeah. Like I've been doing that a lot longer than I have. Give me two decades and if I don't sell a thing, I'll probably end up seeing the same sort of concentration just through hopefully having some winners in there.
Right. Right. So, I mean, I think it's one of those, if you know, you know, kind of things, right? Like you'll get to the point where you're like, you know what? I want to be concentrated. Right. And you're not doing it for some arbitrary reason, like you read it somewhere or because Charlie did it in the 70s or whatever, right? Because you will feel led in that direction, and that's the direction that you'll choose to go, and you will no longer be interested in owning the other 30 or 50 or 100 stocks, and you only want to own this 15 or 10 or whatever the number is. I think that's kind of the way I think about it. John, I'm going to have to ask you to do a favor. I have no idea how to kick you out.
I don't know how to demote you.
I don't see that as a choice.
So I can leave, and then I'll just reconnect.
Awesome. That sounds
good. Thank you for taking
the call. Thanks, John. Good to see you.
Thanks for testing out this feature, John. We appreciate it.
See, I trusted John to leave when I told him to leave. So that was the main reason.
That's why he didn't talk to me either, right?
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. No, I can kick you out. I know how to make you go away, Gilly. So that's it. Okay.
All right. Jason, do you want to, I think this will be fun since we have Jim here. So one of the things we wanted to do was every month we do a brief update on our fun little 2020 portfolio game. And I updated the numbers through the month of November. So maybe we can, you know, spend as much time as we feel is necessary just to kind of talk through some of these names. Because I mean, as much as you're interested in doing this, Jim, I'd be curious what your thoughts are on some of these anyway. Plus, I know Jason wants to brag.
So you ready for me to share the...
Yeah, you can share the...
Oh,
the,
dear. The I don't slide. Know where this is going at all. So this could be...
So in case anyone doesn't know, but... in case you don't know, Jim, we did this fun game starting January 1st. Everyone picked three stocks, the audience, me and Jason together. And then we picked an unportfolio, which Jason did correctly and I did incorrectly.
Oh, Lord.
So this includes dividends. This is the percentage everything is up or down at the end of each month. So from January 1 through the end of each month. And then we do quarterly winners and not, there's more about it that we don't need to go into right now. I think I said last time we talked about this was on the last live show. It's fascinating to me looking at this, how much movement we've seen in some of these companies over the course of just 11 months. And it's especially stark with some of them just from October to November as I was doing this earlier. Like look at Lemonade, went from down 20% to up 29% in 30 days.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of interesting things, directions to go here just about how the market has been generally over the course of this year. And then I think there's some fun individual company stuff to talk about. So
I think the big one for me is just what you were talking about. I'm going to repeat some of what you already said, though. It's just how, and this year's not particularly unique in terms of volatility that you can see,
right?
This is investing in stocks. It's a feature, right? It's the way the market works, right? And it's one of the great things about the market, but it's also one of the worst things about it for most people because people suck at living through this kind of volatility because you can see a stock go down 10% And the part of your brain that like tells you something hurts is the same part that that triggers when you see that loss on the screen. And because of how we've evolved, that 10% loss hurts you more than a double feels good. It's just, that's how we've evolved, right? So that is a reality. And to me, this has just been a great reminder that there's zero at stake here, right? There's some money for some charities that, you know, we're doing from, you know, quarter to quarter and at the end of the year. So it's going to, affect charities getting a little bit of money from me and Jeff, and hopefully from some of our podcast viewers out there chipping in and playing along as well. The biggest thing that's at stake is bragging rights, Jeff, right? But it's just a fun experiment, right? It's a fun experiment.
We're not going to end the contest after a year, you know, what I think will be fun is when we take a look back at this in, you know, whatever, two or 3 years from now, just to kind of see where things have gone.
But if there is like to quote Ben Graham here, you know, the whole voting machine, weighing machine, over time, the weighing machine kicks in.
Right.
And I think we're seeing evidence of that in the performance of my portfolio.
This was a voting machine contest. It'll turn into a weighing machine contest over time.
Yeah. 11 months in, it's absolutely. This is long term for us.
I was going to say, this looks like an advertisement for not concentration to go on.
Highly concentrate, right? That's
all right, Jim. You're not one to hold back. So share your thoughts.
But nice knowing all of you. So my take on this is, look, you're coming into 2023, and 2022, broadly for most investors. It sucked, right? I mean, the indexes were down what they were down. I mean, I think, what was the S&P down 19% and NASDAQ was down 30 odd, the Toronto Stock Exchange, I think it was down, which is out of Canada for those who don't know. I think we were down about 6 or 7%. And so you're kind of and you know, I people were saying at the end of 2022, oh, well, you know, what's the market gonna do next year? And I said, well, you know, the number of back-to-back years where there's been down years has not been many. But in the extenuating, the few that there have been since the 20s, it was either, you know, the great stock market crash of 1929, the early 1940s, I don't know, something was happening worldwide at that point in time. I don't know. I'll go ask my German and Japanese friends. You know, and then there was an extreme valuation event, I believe in the mid 70s where, basically oil sucked and you had runaway inflation. Stop me if that sounds familiar. And then 2000, you know, coming off of a ridiculous overvaluation scenario that was the tech bubble. And so I said, you know, well, you know, it wouldn't shock me if 2023. This should give you the value of predictions, right? It wouldn't shock me if 2023 is another down year. It's another crappy year. Because it looked a lot like the market event in the mid 70s, 73, 74, I think, and mixed with the market event of 2000 through 2002. And so again, the first takeaway I'm going to give you is beware people bearing predictions, because they're going to be wrong. Although I didn't say it's going to be down. I said it wouldn't shock me. But the other thing, if you're going to pull that back up at some point so I can remember what was on there, the other thing is, by starting in 2023, you were starting at pretty, I'm going to say nadirs for certain of those stocks. So,
it was a good time to be kicking off a contest.
It was a good time to be kicking off a contest. And I'm going to pick on Lemonade just because.
You should.
Well, I mean, I've looked at one or two insurance companies in my life. I'll put it that way. I think Lemonade's apt to be a zero over the long term unless they pull their socks up. Okay. And I was saying that at $180.
I've been saying for a long time that the reality is that they've been really good at everything except actually being an insurer.
Well, I think my favorite thing is I was talking to, I think it was the guys from Chit Chat Money actually. And Ryan mentioned what he was paying for his renter's insurance. And I'm like, wow, the last time I was renting was about a quarter century ago. And you're paying literally 20% of what I was paying then. So I'm like, I don't know what you guys are doing at Lemonade, but it sure as hell ain't making money. But, you know, look, but Lemonade has had, you know, like that 29% performance, which is a very nice year, right, for anybody. You know,
back in July, it was 65%.
But even that 65%, you know, go back to the guy who bought it on, you know, in January of 2021, not January 2023.
Right.
You know, they've been obliterated.
No, it's still down 80%, I believe.
Yeah. Well, you know, and maybe they need their COO to go on Seeking Alpha and Twitter again and, you know, jaw at people for not, anyway, that's a whole other thing. But you know, like I think it's a very interesting eclectic mix here. Apologies to anyone who owns Boston Omaha. That's one of the ones that just, you know, they're getting to be, I've called it a waiting for Godot stock, you know, the Samuel Beckett play. Spoiler folks, Godot doesn't show. And boy, that Boston Omaha, 0.85 times book value, all time low right now.
I was going to say, that's the thing. It's kicking off cash and it's
not that much, less than you think. But the interesting thing,
that's why it's discounted, because it's less than you'd think.
Well, but here's the fun thing. So you know they own, it was 22% of Sky Harbor?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
That hasn't moved the stock.
Sky Harbor, since the end of the most recent reported quarter, since the most recent balance sheet, September 30th balance sheet, Sky Harbor, which was held on the books, I don't even remember how much it was, but I should go look it up because I'm pedantic that way. But like Sky Harbor at the end of the, here we go. At the end of the quarter, it was held in the books at just under $59 million. I'm not counting the warrants. I'm just counting the value of the shares. As of yesterday, the value of that holding was $131. So it's more than doubled. So you've got $70 million of value, extra value on the books of Boston Omaha. And Boston Omaha's market cap, which is what, $450 million?
Round figure, that much? That's close enough. Yeah.
They've gone down. But meanwhile, you know, like you're sitting there going like, okay, that's down $45 million, but I'll look at your other big losers here. Outset Medical, I don't know anything about that company, so I'll skip over that one. Blink Charging is a zero.
Well, that's the on portfolio, Jim. So the point of that one was to do badly.
Well, but where are we going to go with that? Well, I noticed there's two ostensibly real companies in there as well.
Yeah, I played the
AMC
game wrong, which I can explain if you're interested, but go ahead, finish your thoughts.
Well, I was just going to say, like, you know, like Boston Omaha is kind of catching up to the garbage there. And I think most people, myself included, and maybe we're all delusional, would suggest that Boston Omaha is a real business run by real intelligent human beings who, as you say, are kicking off cash flows or at least have other investing chops. And the market simply does not care.
Yeah.
And, so do you still have conviction in Boston Omaha, or are you starting to?
I'm not sure. Because
like Matt Frankel, who's a Motley Fool contributor and writer, mm-hmm. I thought had an interesting take on Twitter about this, which was basically they're acting like they're Berkshire Hathaway, but have yet to prove to investors that they deserve to.
Yes, I did see that take. I think that's excellent.
Yeah.
So here's the thing, right? We see a CEO who chats his stock up. We tend to look askance at that.
Right.
But who among us would not want the guys at Boston Omaha to, guys, we give me a stick, I'm going to poke them. Do something.
Yeah, right.
Do something. So we're nothing if not hypocritical. But, you know, I know I've talked a company that you guys know that I've owned for a long time, near and dear to my heart. I'm sorry I'm going off the board here pretty quickly, but hopefully I can make the point. Is a company called Windmark, which, for those who don't know, is the parent company of Play It Again Sports. And,
yeah, I know it's your fault that all I ever hear about from Jeff and text is Windmark.
Yeah, well, let me tell you sometime my cost basis, and then you'll, you know,
yeah, that,
you'll
yeah,
never talk
I,
to
I
me
own
again.
Some too. I got a pretty good cost base.
I have yet to buy it for...
Let me put it this way. The cumulative dividends they paid is more than double my cost basis, so I'll put it that way. Anyway, okay, but besides that point, but like one thing I love about Windmark... And it's a non-value creating, like it's irrelevant to the story, but I love the story, is that their press releases, like I think they dash them off as they're running to the fax machine. Because you
it's
know
great.
These
they're
guys,
great,
like
great.
They're one line.
Yeah.
They're two lines, right? They just don't care. But when your stock has delivered, 25% annual returns for 15 years, dividends reinvested, I think you're allowed to do that.
Right.
When your stock is trading at an all-time valuation low and does nothing and sits there and, you know, and you've taken a few bucks out for incentive compensation, I don't think the Boston Omaha guys should get the, you know, get the benefit of the doubt that Brett Heffes and before him John Morgan at Windmark do.
It's also,
or should.
Well, they don't get the benefit of the doubt. They have credibility, and that's the difference.
But it's also, it's so my frustration, I agree with Matt's take on it too. There was a part of what he said that I think that really resonates with me, which is the fact that it's not that I don't want them doing conference calls necessarily. I don't care about that. I don't need them to go on CNBC. I don't need, but like they at one point said that the asset management part of their business was going to be a lot of things, and it by the numbers has not been, and it's like radio silence about that. Like I went through the 10Q just looking for information because I understand the billboard business. I understand the broadband. I understand the insurance. Those are pretty easy to follow and understand. The asset management piece is a little bit of a black box, or at least to my brain. So I'm just looking for even like the little bland descriptors they put in paragraph form underneath the metrics in a 10Q, you know, revenue here was down this much, you know, because of this and because of that, you know, offset by that. They don't even give that. So it's like, yeah, it's, I don't care bad. About the showy sparse. Stuff. You know, like I like the sparse press releases and no conference call. That's fine with me. But like,
it was kind of a crappy time to be standing up an asset management business, if we're being honest.
I just wish I knew more about it.
Look at the market cap of every publicly traded alternative asset management.
Every publicly traded asset manager, and they got shellacked this year. So
yeah, they're all down by half. So
yeah, Brookfield says hi.
Yeah, they say hi every time I open my portfolio. They have a much smaller voice now than they did a year ago. So
yeah, but no. And as I look here, so my overarching take would be, boy, you really started this at a good time. Our overarching tag, I really like the percentage of, like there's no allocation here, right? So, I mean, like, because I know it's not intended to be that, but like, if you had built your portfolio with equal amounts of this, you're probably doing okay. You're probably kind of enjoying this, you know, especially, but you know, there has been significant valuation multiple appreciation this year, which I think people don't really understand or perhaps don't want to understand. So
yeah, when your stocks are going up, you don't want to hear that's why they're going up.
Well, exactly. And you know, and I don't want to slaughter your cows here, you know, so, you know, because I am your guest. Thank you. So
no,
I
slaughter I'll, away. This was well, meant, no, to, be, I'll go this was meant to be a silly, it was meant to be more illustrative than anything else and to give money to charity, but.
Okay. Well, okay. How's this? Pick your preferred valuation multiple, valuation metrics. We're not going to do a quick deep dive DCF and go tell me what, you know, price to sales. God, I hate that metric. That's a whole other story. You know. I'm old
Jim,
enough to
I just
remember
want to
when
say
25
that there are,
times
there are deep layers of that you just said that run even deeper than you know.
Oh,
it's beautiful.
Probably.
Thing.
Okay.
Thank
anyway.
You. I'll pay you after the show.
What is the value? What have your favorite valuation metrics done for the following stocks on this list here? Mercado Libre, CrowdStrike, Lemonade, Datadog, Platforms, and the company that shall not be named.
They've gone up.
They've expanded.
Yeah, I would.
What did we learn about multiples, valuation multiples in 2022, gentlemen?
Multiple expansions. They revert to the mean. I would say, I want to add a little context. I think it's important. I would say, thinking about I'll take TSMC, Taiwan Semi, because their business has grown a tiny bit. Mostly it's grown because of NVIDIA offsetting the other cyclical downturn in semi. So it's grown a little bit. I would be willing to say that Taiwan Semi's multiple has normalized a bit and coming up. I would be willing to say that Meta's multiple has generally also normalized.
It's come up. I'm not sure I like the word normalized because I'm not sure what normal is real.
Reverting more to like a mean, like a realistic value. It's probably pricey now, but it's not. It was stupid effing cheap in January is what I'm
saying. It was.
Incredibly,
yes.
It was a single digit multiple for one of the most popular businesses in the world.
One of the great pleasures of my life, Jason, is that I bought Lulu, my partner. I bought her some shares in her account at the end of 2020 because she loathes Zuckerberg and Facebook. And then when it And then when it almost tripled for her and I sold it, I made sure to, you know, point that out, you know, that, yeah. See,
there you go. So I will say that multiple expansion is not always, I wanted to say that, Jen, because multiple expansion isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes
it's not.
It's the payoff that you invested expecting to happen, right? But with that said, the vast majority of what's on this menu is you're buying stocks that were probably expensive that are just expensive-er.
Well, that's just it. And that's what where I was going to go with my own, again, because I want to slaughter your sacred cows, I want to slaughter my sacred cows, is again, I've owned Windmark for a long time. Okay. I've recommended it in multiple foolish places going back over 10 years now. Windmark today, roughly, is about 35 times free cash flow. That's expensive for that business. Okay.
Yes.
Especially, you know, most of the time, Windmark has traded, with the exception of the last year, Windmark has traded in the 20, 25, let's even be generous and say 25 times free cash flow. So as a long-term holder of Windmark, who's never sold a share, I have to be here today willing to accept that and they are growing free cash flow, but they ain't growing it as fast as the stock price has been running the last year. I have to be accepting of the fact that I could be waking up a year or two from now with Windmark back at, you know, say the long run average of 25 times free cash flow. And frankly, it probably won't go back to the average. It will, of course, go below the average. And so, you know, am I comfortable taking the 50% haircut? And of course, going back to our longer discussion.
To add to that, because I think this is important when you're thinking it through, it's not going to go to 25 times cash flows by growing its cash flows 50% and the stock price staying the same.
No, right? Probably not.
It's going to generate the same cash flows that steady business is generating. And the stock's going to go down because some reason the stock's going to go down.
Yeah. And so it becomes that, and we're back to thinking about mindset and what Charlie taught us and about, you know, cause he famously has got all variations of long-term thinking and being an investor and just, you know, but, you know, an earlier question from Jeff or an earlier point from Jeff, the whole idea of how has the world changed? Again, I kind of came to investing right as the internet was starting to become a thing. I mean, I still remember dial-up modems, for crying out loud. I think the pace of we want answers and we want information. I mean, it's gone ludicrous. It's ludicrous speed, to quote Spaceballs nowadays, right?
Like straight through Plaid, right to ludicrous.
Exactly. It all comes back to that other company. But yeah, no, it's gone ludicrous on us. I think the investing world is poorer for it. I think people need to slow down, but they need to know what everything means all the time. And it's, most of the time, probably means not much, if anything.
So. I think that's been the fun part about, you know, every month in a shorter way and every quarter in a little bit more of an in-depth way, sort of talking through what this year has been with this contest. Like, I don't know that we fully thought through like how illustrative it would be of a lot of the different things you kind of have to think about in investing. You know, like what we've said before, you know, just using Lemonade as an example, because it was down 20% at the end of October and up 29% at the end of November. You know, it's obviously not that much better of a business after a month. You know, and I think if I'm understanding your point correctly about multiple expansion, like that's sort of the same idea, that just because it went up doesn't mean the business is that much better. And sometimes when it goes down, doesn't mean the business is that much worse. And I think it's just been fun sort of kind of talking through that as we've used these stocks as sort of like a proxy for lessons to be learned.
So we've got a question that's come in from Ken. After this question, Jim, I'd love for you to weigh in on it. I know you've got a hard stop coming up here. So after this question, if you want to head out the door and Jeff and I will finish up, we'll do a round of shots. Ken's question.
I feel bad. I've got my water here. Like, you know.
Yeah, I got water too. Like, square, I was not prepared for this. I was not prepared.
Yeah. So Ken's question is, do you think Ken's also not sure. He's got a marathon. For those that aren't following in the chat, he's got a marathon he's running on Sunday. So he's also
good luck
running lean. Yeah. Good luck. Go win. He says, do you think it's better to start investing on a bear or bull market, assuming that your earnings are going to be growing over time? I love this question.
I love this question too, but
go ahead. You first, guess first.
Can open worms everywhere, man. I mean, I think it is absolutely unquestioned the best time to start investing is when there's blood in the streets. Bear market, the bear has mauled the bull, and people are, I'm never going to invest again. This is a racket. The market is rigged, that yada, yada, yada.
The moment of capitulation.
My father-in-law. My father-in-law stopped investing. I don't know what happened. Something happened in the late 80s, and he's never invested again. To his detriment.
Something happened in 87 on a single day.
I honestly don't know. There's very long, complicated stories. You guys have heard some dad stories. You know, he's truly, what's the opposite of a Renaissance man? Whatever that is, that's my father-in-law. But anyway, he did.
Jim, you know, this is a live public show, right?
That's fine, man. It's not news. That's not news. And, you know, hey, I've heard you guys curse on this show. I've heard you curse me out on this show. So I figure I get to. That really impressed my kids, by the way. They're very impressed that, you know, dad's a big enough deal that
we do that just to make sure you're listening.
To go after himself. Anyway, sorry. No, I think you really, the best time to invest, I'm going to go back to a bear market that felt awful at the time. Okay. 2008, it was so bad. It killed the foolish product that I was running at the time because, I mean, they couldn't, I mean, they short-sightedly, in my opinion, they made the decision they couldn't market it. And I understand why. It was a product called Paydirt. It's the most fun I've ever had as an investor, though. But like in that era, and Paydirt was a product that was focused on small cap companies priced for death. Okay. Because companies that don't die tend to like double or triple or quadruple. The problem is when you have a worldwide global financial crisis, that kind of changes the calculus a little bit. And so in, you know, the market felt, I mean, you know, Jason, you were there. I know Jeff, you weren't in the game at that point, but, I can tell you it felt awful. It felt horrible. It didn't matter what you picked. It didn't matter what you recommended. I actually had a meeting where no one would make a decision. And I had to kind of drop the hammer on the other analysts around the table going like, guys, doesn't matter what we pick. It's going to be down 10, 15% next week. Okay. Does not matter. We got to pick some. Okay. Like let's focus up here. And my thing is in 2008, as the carnage is all around you, tell me if you've ever heard of these tickers. Okay. Some company called Starbucks. I don't know. Starbucks, you could buy Starbucks for $4. And by the way, this is before they started paying a dividend in 2010. Okay. What's their dividend right now? Anybody know?
Not off the top of my head.
Pull it up quick.
Like I'm about to go look it up. But Starbucks, okay, you bought Starbucks for under $4. Starbucks is a $100 stock today that pays you $2.28 a year. Okay. Oh, and by the way, they're going to raise that next year. Okay. Mm-hmm. You could have bought Home Depot. Again, is this a company that, have you ever heard of? Apparently they're a hardware store. I don't know, man. You could have bought Home Depot for $19 in March of 2009. Okay. Home Depot today is a $320 stock and pays you $8.36 a year in dividends. The problem inherent in Ken's question is unquestionably you want to start investing in a bear market. And almost no one does because the fear impulse that you talked earlier about.
Because the problem is you don't know what the hell you're doing and you're starting it in a bear market.
You're terrified. And the worst time to start investing is in a bull market when everything is going up every day because the worst times in my investing career to have started investing were 99 and I'm going to say 2021. Those are the absolute worst times to start investing. The absolute best times to start investing were 2002 and 2008 or 9. And maybe the first downdraft of COVID 2020, but you know, like that was you know, the problem is it is a problem of human psychology. And as already intimated, we are really, really bad at that type of decision making.
That's why we're here, is to help have a community.
Well, we're certainly trying. Anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much. Everyone listening along, thank you very much for indulging me.
Thanks for coming on, Jim.
I have a daughter to run to swim practice.
Go do it.
So, anyway,
I got a better idea. You should drive her.
I probably will. Yes. Anyway, okay. Thanks, guys.
It's always fun, Jim. See ya. Yeah. So
I think he answered that question entirely correctly from like a logical standpoint. But I also think, I don't know, maybe I'm sensitive to it because I kind of started in both.
It was both because it happened so fast.
Right. Like I bought stocks in my first stock in February of 2020, which was normalish. And then it sure as hell wasn't. for a different reason.
Yeah.
You know, but.
Well, I think what Ken said sums it up. And I want to add to that is like the upside is, as Ken says, I like that I got crushed really early and learned a lot. And that's awesome because the stakes are lower too. For most people, like if you're not, you know, if unless you're in your 40s and you cash out your 401k and you throw $250,000 at the market at the peak and things go like they did last year and you sell and walk away, right? And you're done with it, right? That's a horrible outcome. But if the stakes are low and you learn and you keep doing it, that's good. But Ken, the reality is that 99% of the people that got crushed, guess what? They're not still listening to investing podcasts.
It really depends. Yeah. The bottom line answer to that question is it depends.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it depends on a few things. It depends on the kind of person you are, like your risk tolerance, your level of understanding. And I think a lot of it has to do with where you are in your life financially. Like, so technically I started investing in September of 2021, because that's when I got my first job and I contributed to an index fund in a retirement account. So like in the sense of like,
you're blurry. I do remember. I've only had one beer, so I don't think that's me. You're blurry.
Oh no, that's just, that's you because it happens on your, never mind. We're not going to get into it for the audience. But my point is I saw like the impact of that just getting quarterly statements, you know, like, holy cow, I have a lot less money than I did 3 months ago, you know, a little bit of an impact. Mm-hmm. But I think, and I think what got me, I know it wasn't a true bear market. You're right, Jen. But I think what got me through like the craziness of 2020, 2021, 2022 was the fact that I'm not brand new to that, like not brand new to like understanding how money in the market works. You know, if I were 22, brand new at right out of college during that time, maybe it's a different story. I was also buying tiny, tiny amounts of stocks at that point too. So I could, you know, a big drawdown, you know, was not going to kill me. But anyway, we're up on an hour here. So any closing thoughts here, Jason, as we wrap up our second ever live First Friday show?
Yeah, I'm going to share what Sina just said here. It matters less when you start than that you keep going. I would add to that and just say, start now, start small, keep learning, keep growing, and then it will keep growing too, right? I mean, I think that's the thing. If you're answering that question for somebody else, do that. That's all I got, Jeff. That's it.
That's almost a uncomfortably perfect way to end it. So let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. Well, just a reminder, we ain't giving advice. We're giving our answers to these questions. It is up to you each to find your own answer. You can do it. I believe in you, and Jeff believes in you too. Jeff, we'll see you next time, buddy.
See you next time. Thanks, everyone.